Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, among other works, journalist and author Naomi Klein is famous for her 2007 book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. The shock Klein explored there was the manipulation of international crisis situations to implement so-called neoliberal free market policies. Like many people, Klein was also shocked by the election of President Donald Trump. On November 8, 2016, the New York Times predicted Hillary Clinton had an 85% chance of winning. They fleshed that out with a football analogy, explaining that Clinton's chance of losing was about the same as the chance of an NFL kicker missing a 37-yard field goal.
And the kick is no good!
Oops. On a recent stop in Seattle, Naomi Klein read from the conclusion of her new book, No is Not Enough, Resisting Trump's Shock Politics and Winning the World We Need. She focused on the end, she said, because she knew Seattle could, quote, handle her cutting to the chase. Naomi Klein then invited a special guest on stage, someone whose appearance had not been announced. Princeton professor Kianga Yamada Taylor is the author of From Hashtag Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. In a recent college commencement address, she referred to President Trump as a, quote, racist, sexist, megalomaniac, unquote. When the quote made the rounds of certain news programs, Taylor experienced online harassment and death threats. Due to those threats, she canceled a talk in Seattle late last month. Given the context, her friend Naomi Klein was glad to find a way for Taylor to be heard. This reading and discussion took place at the Neptune Theater on June 22nd. Thank you to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum.
My name is Anthony Rogers Wright. I'm the U.S. coordinator for the LEAP. Been on the road with Naomi for 3 days now. It's really good to be home in Seattle. It's so good to be home. I have the amazing honor of introducing brother Mr. Ken Workman of the Duwamish Nation, the great, 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 great grandson of Chief Seattle, to offer a blessing.
Thank you, Anthony. Thank you. If it's okay with you, I'd like to speak in a language that we weren't allowed to speak for so very long. The language is called the Lushootse. And so down here in this part of the country, we would use Southern Lushootse for thank you, and that would be kwadi. So when I say askwaditiv chetisiaya twaldugwi hutch, Twaldugwi Gwasishai, Twaldugwi Bak Stab. This is just our way of saying thank you, my friends, for your heart, for your brains, for your for all things. Twal yuf hekwa walof atzats iltabif, and for being strong people. But because we're here in Seattle and there's so many people that come from so many places, we also like to say thank you to all of them. And so for our friends that come down from Alaska, our Tlingit friends, we say Gunolchish. And if you come down a little bit further than that and you talk to the Haida, they would go, Hawa is the word that they use. And their Tsimshian neighbors, Deutschum. If I come down to Vancouver Island and our new Chenault friends, they make a little different sound for this word, thank you. They use the word Eiko. And so we know where you're from by what you sound like. And so for our friends on the Canadian border, they go Haishka. And for our Tulalip friends just north of us, they use the word Tig. So they would say Otigweetseed. And for our friends on the Columbia River, our Cowlitz, our Chinookan friends, they would use the words Hayas Masi or Hayo Masi. And so it is wonderful to see you here today. Asaslav Dubisi, Judge Siaya. It's wonderful to see you. You have Asquidit of Chet Twal Dugwe, Hekwa Ibashid of Asquis Watuftit. And thank you for your journey, Ibasha da Fasquaiswatu, on Mother Earth. Adisha Hekwa, all. I'm all good of this big place, this land. Adisha Hekwa, all. This big house. Hekwa Disha, all good of Ata Dwabs, this place that we used to call Duwamish. Asquadita Shatwal, Dagwe Hekwa Oyayus, and for your big work. In my language, when we introduce ourselves, we do this generally. We go through our fathers and our mothers and our grandfathers and our grandmothers and great, and all the way back until we start seeing some head nods. And we go, oh, okay, now you know, we know who you are. So, Yayustobs Tizda is how you would say, my name is Workman. Yayustobs Tizda at Duwabs, I am Workman of the Duwamish. Yavakwa Yekwa, Akwa Yekwa, Siab Sialchad. And great-great-great-great-grandson of Chief Seattle. And we say it like this so that people coming to this land, they will know where they are, where this place is, and they will know who you are by your name, and they will know who your family is by these names that we keep citing until we see heads nod. And so I would like to say, welcome everybody onto this land. And so when I say gui, this word, it means invite. But when I go gui gui hedak, it means invite everybody. And so like my grandfather who stood on the shores over here just 170 years ago, when there was virtually no white people here, and he said, gui gui hedak to siaya, slalio hadish ogura fata duwams. And that simply said, welcome my friends, come ashore onto this land of the Duwamish. And so I say to you here today, it is a great honor for me to carry on in the tradition of my grandfather, the person that you know as Chief Seattle, when I say, Gwigwi Hedak, Gwigwi Hedak, Gwigwi Hedak, Hoi.
I've missed you, Seattle. I'm so glad to be back. I first want to thank Ken Workman for that heartfelt, multilingual welcome to these beautiful stolen lands and for being such an important part of the movement for Indigenous land rights and restitution. I also want to thank Rick from Elliott Bay Books. Thank you for being here, supporting such a wonderful independent bookseller. And also Deborah from the Seattle Theater Group. And as you heard, I published this book with Haymarket, and it's just been such a pleasure. I have been writing books critical of multinational corporations for almost 20 years. So it's to my great shame that this is the first book I've ever published with a radical independent publisher. It feels really great to know that as the book succeeds, it's helping Haymarket to succeed. This is a book that I wrote to try to play some small part in growing an amazing movement, and it is great to be with a publisher that is committed to those very same goals. You heard from my wonderful colleague, Anthony Rogers Wright. He's going to be coming back on stage at the end of the evening to talk about some of the amazing local groups who you may have seen on your way in, who have tables here. We are also going to be hearing from a young man who is suing the U.S. government for failing to protect his generation from the climate crisis. So it's going to be a rich and multi-layered evening, and I really want to urge all of you to stay here and not miss any of it. And as you leave, make sure to check out the tables of the local groups and find out more. I'm going to just spend a few minutes, reading from the new book, and I'm going to make an assumption about Seattle audiences by cutting to the chase and reading from the conclusion. I think you're ready for that, okay? All right. A great many people, myself included, have used the word shock to describe Donald Trump's election and the first months of his presidency, and understandably so. In his first week in office, Trump signed a tsunami of executive orders that had people reeling, madly trying to keep up. Since then, he's never allowed the atmosphere of crisis to let up. But as I've reflected on the word shock, I started to question its accuracy. A state of shock is produced when a story is ruptured, a bolt from the blue. But in so many ways, Trump is not a rupture at all, but rather the culmination, the logical endpoint of a great many dangerous stories our culture has been telling for a very long time. That greed is good, that the market rules, that money is all that matters in life, that white men are better than the rest, that the natural world is there for us to pillage, that the vulnerable deserve their fate, and the 1% deserve their golden towers, that anything public and commonly held is sinister and not worth protecting, that we are surrounded by danger and should only look after our own, and that there is no alternative to any of this. Given that these stories are the very air we breathe, Trump really shouldn't come as a shock. A billionaire president who boasts he can grab women by the genitals while calling Mexicans rapists and jeering at the disabled is the logical expression of a culture that grants indecent levels of impunity to the ultra-rich, that is consumed with winner-take-all competition, and that is grounded in dominance-based logic at every level. We should have been expecting him. And indeed, many of those most directly touched by the underbelly of Western racism and misogyny have been expecting him for a long time. So maybe the emotion behind what some have been calling shock is really, more accurately, horror. Specifically, the horror of recognition that we feel when we read effective dystopian fiction or watch good dystopian films. All stories of this genre take current trends and follow them to their logical conclusion, and then use that conclusion to hold up a mirror and ask, do you like what you see? Do you really want to continue down this road? These nightmare futures are horrifying precisely because they are not shocking. Not a break from our underlying stories, but their fulfillment. I've come to believe that we should see America's first nuclear arm reality TV show branded president in a similar fashion, as dystopian fiction come to life. Trump is a mirror held up not only to the United States, but to the world. If we don't like what we see, and throngs of us clearly do not, we know what we must do. We have to question not only Trump, but the values and systems that ineluctably produced him, the same values that have been playing out in destroyed safety nets, exploding prison populations, surging white supremacy, normalized rape culture, democracy-destroying trade deals, and rising seas. At the same time, perhaps it's okay, healthy even, for us to be just a little bit shocked by Trump. Here's why. Those stories that produced him were always contested. There were always other stories, ones that insisted that money is not all that's valuable, and that all of our fates are intertwined with one another and with the health of the natural world. The forces Trump represents have always tried to suppress those other, older, and self-evidently true stories, often violently, so that theirs could dominate against so much intuition and evidence. And the persistence of these other stories should remind us that while Trump is the logical culmination of the current neoliberal system, the current neoliberal system is not the only possible culmination of the human story. Which is why part of our work now, a key part, is not just resistance, not just saying no, We have to do that, of course, but we also need to fiercely protect some space to dream and plan for a better world. This isn't an indulgence. It's an essential part of how we defeat Trumpism. For me, and this may sound a bit strange, Trump's rise has also prompted a more internal kind of challenge. It has made me determined to kill my inner Trump. How about you? Is there anything just a little bit Trumpish worth examining? Maybe it's the part whose attention span is fracturing into 140 characters and that is prone to confusing followers with friends. Maybe it's the part that's learned to see ourselves as brands in the marketplace rather than as people in communities. Or the part that sees other people doing similar work, not as potential allies in a struggle that will need all of our talents, but as rival brands competing for scarce market share. Given that Trump's presidency is the culmination of corporate branding's insidious logic, perhaps it's time to leave some of that behind. Or maybe it's the part that just can't resist joining a mob to shame and attack people with whom we disagree, sometimes using cruel personal slurs with an intensity set to nuclear. Or maybe, just maybe, it's the part that is secretly waiting for a billionaire to ride to the rescue, except that this one will be kind and generous and concerned about climate change and empowerment for girls. The liberal billionaire savior myth may appear very far from Trump, but the fantasy still equates great wealth with superhero powers, which, once again, is just a little too close for comfort to His Majesty of Mar-a-Lago. If some of these impulses and stories seem hardwired in us, it's for a very simple reason. Willingly or not, anyone who consumes and produces media swims in the cultural waters of reality TV and personal branding and nonstop attention-splintering messages, the same waters that produce the Trump presidency. There are different parts of that fetid swimming pool, to be sure. And some people are in zones with no lifeguards and with way more waterborne diseases than others. But it's still hard to get genuinely outside of the pool. Recognizing this can help clarify our task. To have a hope of changing the world, we're going to have to be willing to change both the culture and ourselves. And a great many of us are clearly ready for that, for a captivating, transformative vision that lays out a plan for tangible improvements in daily life, unafraid of powerful words like redistribution and reparation and maybe even democratic socialism. And perhaps we should thank Trump for this newfound ambition, at least in part. The shamelessness of his corporate coup has done a tremendous amount to make systemic change seem more necessary to a lot of people. Because if titans of American industry can eagerly line up behind this man, and if Wall Street can cheer on news of his plans to let the planet burn and the elderly starve, and if so much of the media can praise his cruise missiles, ordered over chocolate cake as presidential, well, then a great many people are coming to the conclusion that they want no part of a system like that. With this elevation of the basest of figures to the most exalted of positions, the culture of maximum extraction, of endless grabbing and disposing, is reaching some kind of breaking point. Clearly, it is the culture itself that must be confronted now, and not just policy by policy, but at the root. For decades, elites have been using the power of shock to impose nightmares. Donald Trump thinks he'll be able to do it again, that we will be overwhelmed by events and will ultimately scatter, surrender, and let him grab whatever he wants. But crises do not always cause societies to regress and give up. There is also always a second option, that faced with a grave common threat, we can choose to come together and make an evolutionary leap. We can choose, as the Reverend William Barber puts it, to be the moral defibrillators of our time and shock the heart of this nation and build a movement of resistance and hope and justice and love. We can, in short, surprise the hell out of ourselves by being united, focused, and determined, by refusing to fall for these tired old shock tactics, by refusing to be afraid no matter how much we are tested, and we will be tested. The corporate coup Trump and his billionaire cabinet is trying to pull off is a crisis with global reverberations that could echo through geologic time. How we respond to this crisis is up to us. So let's choose that second option. Let's leap. Thank you. Thank you. So, as you saw in the promotions for this event, the plan was for me to be in conversation with Jesse Hagopian, a local Seattle teacher and hero who's become a friend of mine. I asked Jesse if we could be in dialogue about this book because he'd reached out to me a few years back about the shock doctrine, and he told me at the time that he had seen the shock doctrine in action when he was in Haiti during that horrific earthquake. And he'd also seen it in the school system where he works as a teacher. So I had wanted to talk to him about this book because it deals in part with how shocks are shaping events once again. And I also wanted to talk to him because we cannot understand Trump and Trumpism without understanding the rise of anti-black racism and surging white supremacy, something Jesse knows a lot about as a Black Lives Matter activist. As many of you know, Jesse sued the Seattle Police Department after he was pepper sprayed while walking down the street talking on the phone at a MLK Day demonstration. And scandalously, the officer involved received nothing more than a verbal reprimand. But they did come to a financial settlement, and Jesse used that money to create a racial justice scholarship fund for young people. And just this week, they awarded the scholarships to a terrific group of students with the help of another one of your local heroes, Seattle Seahawk Michael Bennett. Yes, that deserves a round of applause. And we planned this some weeks ago, but as the date for the event approached, I was painfully aware that it was particularly important to be in dialogue with Jesse now because of the state of grief so many in the city are in after the horrifying police killing of Charlena Lyles. Pregnant with three of her four kids in the house with her, she had called the police to report a burglary, and she was murdered. Her kids had to walk over her body. Jesse, just this past week, helped lead an effort to claim Charlena Lyles as a beloved part of the Seattle education system with kids enrolled in Seattle schools. And earlier this week, hundreds of teachers went to school wearing Black Lives Matter t-shirts, standing up for Charlena Lyles and saying her name. This is the same week, let us not forget, that the police officer who shot Philando Castile without provocation while he was in his car was scandalously acquitted. And just yesterday, we saw new horrifying footage that confirmed just how unprovoked that attack was. Castile was a beloved employee at a Montessori school in St. Paul, Minnesota. I've been on book tour now for a couple of weeks. And I really have to tell you that at every stop, I've heard more stories of this kind of hatred and violence, and places are really feeling like a tinderbox. Now, the right doesn't have a monopoly on violence. We launched the book in Washington, D.C. on the day of that horrific shooting at the baseball practice that targeted Republican lawmakers. the city was in shock. And I was lucky enough that night to share the stage with the woman many of you know, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal. And she helped ground us and put those attacks in perspective. Because we know that so much more violence is being directed at people of color. Earlier this week, Nabra Hassanem, a Muslim teen, was killed with a baseball bat in a suburb of Washington, D.C., that same city. And if that wasn't bad enough, 2 days later, a memorial for her in downtown Washington, D.C. was set on fire. Sorry, just 2 days ago. We were in Portland on Monday, and I shared the stage there with Joanne Hardesty, a leader of the local NAACP chapter. And of course, we talked about the heroic young men who had been killed less than a month ago on Portland Public Transit, the MAX, after intervening to try to stop the harassment of 2 girls of color, one wearing a hijab. Joanne shared with us that though these men were indeed local heroes, their deaths might have been prevented. Why? Because the day before, this same white supremacist rage machine had thrown a bottle at an African-American woman, and she'd called the police to report the attack. But according to Joanne, the police didn't take that attack seriously enough, and in fact started questioning the woman who had just been attacked, treating her like a criminal. How many times does this have to happen? That black people turn to the police for help and end up being profiled themselves, or worse, killed? So Jesse and I were going to be talking about this, but for personal reasons, he has been unable to take part in the conversation tonight, and I respect his decision. So in a big hurry, I tried to think about who I could invite instead to help us understand this moment and all of our responsibilities in it. And I thought immediately about my friend Kianga Diamada Taylor, author of the brilliant book From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, also published by Haymarket. Kianga, who is a faculty member at Princeton, was one of just 4 people who read No Is Not Enough in draft form and gave me invaluable feedback and made the book better. So I asked her to do that because she is one of the sharpest intellects in the country when it comes to connecting our brutal economic system that has concentrated so much wealth, such obscene levels of wealth, into so few hands. She connects that with the targeting of people of color, with women and members of LGBTQ communities. I love Kianga, but I thought, well, Kianga can't come, because Kianga has herself been the target of this rising tide of race-based hatred. Just 3 weeks ago, she had to cancel a speech here in Seattle at the town hall, at another in San Diego, after a wonderful commencement address she gave at Hampshire College was seized upon by Fox News, and it went viral in all the wrong circles. She had dared to tell those graduating students the truth about Donald Trump's racism and misogyny, and that was apparently unacceptable, because as the clip circulated, all of a sudden she was inundated with extremely specific and graphic death threats. So much so that after consulting with experts, she did not consider it safe to stand in front of rooms like this when her presence had been advertised long in advance. So Kianga hasn't been doing public events lately, which is a real loss to our movements, because we need her voice now more than ever. She's letting things cool off. But you know, I called Kianga anyway, and I told her the situation with Jesse, and I said, well, what if we don't tell anyone that you're coming until the last minute before you walk on stage? Because I know many people in Seattle were saddened when you had to cancel and want to hear from you. And you know what? She said yes. She said... She said yes. That she's ready to come back. So please join me in welcoming my friend, my hero, Kianga Diamada Taylor. Kianga.
Hello.
So, I have a question for you. Why did you decide to come?
Well, first let me just thank you for inviting me. It's very exciting to actually be here in Seattle under a different set of circumstances. So let me just say why I didn't come. Naomi gave some of the backstory. On May 20th, I'd given a commencement address at Hampshire College in Western Massachusetts. And in the speech, you know, I may have talked about Donald Trump for 90 seconds out of a 20-minute address where I referred to him as a racist and sexist megalomaniac. Really, words that I thought were uncontroversial. And the people at Hampshire liked the speech that so much that they created a separate video and circulated it, and by the end of the week it had been seen many times, and at that point had fallen into the consciousness of the people at Fox News, who I later came to find out did a print story about the speech on Thursday, ran a television segment on Friday, ran another television segment on Saturday, and ran another print story about a speech from a junior faculty member speaking to a group, you know, a graduating class at a liberal arts college. So they did four news stories over Memorial Day weekend. And I started getting threats, you know, racist emails, death threats over the next several days. And so I was supposed to give a talk here on the Wednesday, and I was actually I had been working all morning. I went home to just sort of get my things together at the last minute, and I got an email from an officer at Princeton who I had sent all of the emails to the day before, and he sent me an email asking if I could call him, you know, that afternoon. And this was 4 hours before my flight. And so I called the officer, and he said that, I just want you to know that we find these emails to be extremely alarming. And he started to rattle off a number of security protocols that I should implement. And so, you know, I had already been sort of nervous and uneasy. I've never received death threats. I've gotten, you know, I write a lot, and so I've certainly gotten nasty emails from conservatives who don't like what I have to say about things periodically, but never anything like this. I think in 4 days I got 56 emails. There were another dozen emails sent to my department, and you know, I continued. I think in total I got something like 70 emails. And so the last thing that the officer said to me when we got off the phone was that if at any point in time you don't feel comfortable about something, then just don't do it. And so this was in the context, as people know, of the student at University of Maryland having been killed by someone associated with an alt-right student group on Facebook. It was a few days after the murders in Portland. And, you know, it was a very tension-filled moment for me and for you know, my family and for just in general at that point. And so I made the decision not to come. But having said all that, I do think that it's important to, it's one, understanding that there is a strategy for some people to really harangue and harass people that they think, particularly on college campuses right now, who they perceive to be radical or liberal or who really think differently from them, to harass and harangue them into silence. And so it's not just me. There's Professor Saida Grundy from Boston University 2 years ago who tweeted about white supremacy and received death threats and threats to her job. Zandria Robinson, who's a professor at Rhodes College, a black woman who tweeted about racism, who wrote an article about racism, received death threats and threats to her job. And there's a professor just recently, Johnny Eric Williams at University of Connecticut, who received so many threats that yesterday at Trinity College in Connecticut received so many death threats yesterday that the police actually shut down the college for fear of his safety and people on the campus. George Cicciariello Mayer, who is white, who has tweeted about racism and has been viciously attacked by neo-Nazis and alt-right, and who is currently under investigation at his college and university. Professor Dana Cloud, who's at the University of Syracuse, who was involved in organizing an anti-racist protest in response to an alt-right demonstration in Syracuse, has just in the last 10 days has been the recipient of death threats and calls for her job. And so there's a climate that exists right now where there are small right-wing news outlets who are really working in collusion with Fox News to target, harass, and intimidate academics who speak out against racism, who talk about racism. And I think that, you know, it's important to stand up to that and to not cow to that, even though, you know, it can be complicated. It raises complications at one's workplace and with one's family. But, you know, this is part of a broader trend that is happening in this country, and it needs to be talked about, and it needs to actually be incorporated more, I think, into the organizing and the politics and the movement building that we're engaged in right now.
And this... this little snapshot that I gave of, you know, what we just saw just this week on this little small book tour scratches the surface of what is going on. And a lot of it's not new and predates Trump. And some of it is new or happening at another kind of level. So how do you see what is happening now in terms of a difference from pre-Trump?
Well, I think that we begin with the understanding that racism is systemic in to the United States, that in a country, you know, born of the genocide of its native population, that made its original wealth from the enslavement of Africans, and that tripled, you know, that wealth in untold ways through the brutal exploitation of waves of immigrant labor, that racism is part of the marrow of the United States. So we have to begin with that. But I do think that what we have now, I mean, for the previous 50 years or so, because of the civil rights movement and because of the black insurgency of the 1960s and 70s, that it put conditions upon the way that racism was enacted on in our society. And so it no longer was possible for elected officials to be openly racist. It became socially unacceptable for open displays of racism in ways that didn't exist prior to the civil rights movement or the Black Power struggles. And so what we're now seeing is a kind of naked embrace from the, you know, starting with the President of the United States, of virulent, naked racism, in some cases, an extreme racist innuendo in other cases, that really open up the gateway for many other people to kind of engage in this type of behavior. And so if you have a president who, as you said in your opening remarks, who openly refers to Latinos, Mexicans in particular, as rapists, and who you know, calls for a ban on Muslims. And you know, I don't know if people even remember when he was running as a candidate. At one point, he's making up some ludicrous story, but about dipping bullets in pigs' blood and shooting Muslims with those bullets. And so this is a kind of extreme sort of open racism that we haven't really seen in formal politics in this country in a very long time. And I do think that it's important to remember or to think about it within the context that it's happening, because I don't think that racism is ever fueled in the United States in such a way just for the sake of itself, that it's not just about a kind of naked hatred for Black people or for other non-white people, but that it's always attached to a broader agenda. And in this case, I don't think that there's, you know, that it's simple coincidence that Trump has this kind of three-pronged strategy of anti-Black racism, anti-immigrant hysteria, and Islamophobia that is combined with an economic agenda of complete austerity and hardship intended for poor and working class people in this country. And in fact, both of those go together, that the way that you get ordinary white people to accept their condition in this country is to get them to blame other groups of people for it. And so I think that that is important to, you know, I think that that's important to keep in mind. And that related to all of this in terms of how these crises are managed, I think that's the context within which we understand the presence of racist and violent policing in communities of color. That when we have a political regime, and this certainly does predate Trump, where you have both parties locked in bipartisan agreement that we will no longer support a welfare state, that we will no longer support programs that are intended to lift people out of poverty, to give people access to good jobs, that we will no longer support any programs like that, well then how do you manage the inevitable crises that develop because of that lack of basic attention? And even beyond just the issue of social programs, the complete starvation of public infrastructure. So our public hospitals, public schools, the notion that there is a public responsibility in the first place, how do you manage that? It's through policing. It's through intense policing. So that in a city like Chicago, I don't know what it is here in Seattle, and someone, you know, should find out if people don't already know, but in the city of Chicago, 50% of the operating budget of the city goes to the police. So this is a city in Chicago where in 2012, 52 public schools were closed. 50% of the budget goes to the police. And so that is the public policy of last resort, mm-hmm. that, you know, whether they're Democratic or Republican local administrations, city governments have come to rely on, because they are no longer in the business of funding the public infrastructure or backing and supporting programs that are intended to change these situations.
And it's striking how often in these shooting cases, mental illness comes up. right? And these are people who need help.
Right.
They need care. And instead, they're facing gunshots, right?
Yes.
And so this, I mean, is clearly connected to a public health crisis.
Right. And you can see it in, and I'm from Chicago, which is why it's a reference point for me, but in the same budget that allowed for 52 public schools to be closed, half of the public mental health clinics were also closed. And so these things often go together, where in jails across the country, they have become the mental health facilities because the public hospitals that at least at one point were supposed to attend to these matters have had their budget cut, have had their budgets cut, and are no longer in a viable position to do that. And so really the only public institutions that don't have to endure belt tightening and budget cuts are police, are jails, and are prisons. And so that is what is becoming the public sector and social services that will respond to the crises of poverty, underemployment that exist in the cities across the country.
And another piece of this, right, is how race is used to justify the starving of the public sector, right? The whole narrative that it is Black people, that it's immigrants who are gaming the system, exploiting the system, not paying their share, right? And I was really, I want to ask you to talk more about that, because I really feel that this, like, deeply understanding how these reinforcing systems and rejecting this absurd dichotomy that it's either we focus on economics or and class, or we focus on so-called identity politics, right? That the task is to connect the dots and tell this coherent story and a coherent history, a truthful history, right? One of the things that struck me about this killing, this horrific killing on the Max in Portland, right, is that in the reports, the eyewitness reports about what this guy, Jeremy Christian, who's the attacker, the killer, had said to these young women, he said, go back to where you come from. But he also said, get off the bus, you don't pay taxes, right? So he's echoing this line that he heard somewhere, right, about how people of color are freeloaders. He's literally saying that in the moments before the killing.
Well, it's an old trope. It's an old narrative that I think at one point in the 60s, actually, Lyndon Johnson referred to the differences between tax eaters and tax makers. And so this division between, who pays taxes and therefore is deserving of public services is an old one. But, it's also one that is built on lies, like the idea that there are, or that undocumented immigrants don't pay taxes in this country. But I do think that, it's an old narrative. I was talking earlier today. I had seen a news story where Donald Trump made some speech earlier this week where he actually said that he wants to pursue legislation that prevents immigrants from collecting welfare for the first 5 years that they're in the United States. And It's so problematic on so many levels. First of all, it might be news to him. He is a billionaire, of course, and not all that in touch with the daily news or history. But there really is no welfare in this country for immigrants to collect. Last year was the 20th anniversary of Bill Clinton's efforts to change the welfare state as we know it and to end welfare as an entitlement to poor people in this country. Now, it's possible for people to get access to food stamps and that sort of thing. But the idea that immigrants are coming to the United States for its generous welfare system is really just based on a racist lie that ignores the real contribution that immigrants, whether they're documented or not, make to the economy. And it's the same sort of racist mythology that Donald Trump has tapped into, where at one point in one of his extemporaneous campaign speeches, he talked about moving people from welfare to work. Again, a statement that has absolutely no correspondence with the political reality in the United States today, but is a wink and a nod to his white base that he's gonna get black people off of welfare. And again, an idea that has no basis in reality. And so to me, this is the most base kind of cheap race baiting that is intended to titillate his base without actually providing anything substantive. Because when you look at the heart of his platform, his agenda, what is there in that is really about transforming the conditions that exist for working class people in general, whether they're white, whether they're African American, Latino? It is absolutely nothing. It's not even smoke and mirrors. It is racism, bluff, and bluster that is directed at people.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. This reading and discussion took place at the Neptune Theater on June 22nd. Thanks again to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. Tune in again soon.